listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone. We have a live one today.
That's true. Yeah. Most of our interviews lately have been by phone because they've been with people from all over the country.
Right.
But today we have a exciting young author.
Local boy.
Who grew up in Fairfield.
Uh-huh. And went to school and now is a published author. And I'm going to ask you right off the top, how is the book doing?
It's doing surprisingly well. So far I've really...
Well, I'm not surprised. Well.
By the way, we should tell his name.
Oh, yes.
Ron Kerr.
Ron Kerr, yes.
Son of Ron and Phyllis Kerr here in Fairfield, an MSAE graduate. So welcome to Writer's Voices, Ron.
Thank you. So yeah, surprisingly well, it's been selling. Considering so far I've really only marketed to friends and family, it's been doing surprisingly well for that. Right now my focus is starting to get more on getting people I don't know to buy the book.
Of course.
Which, as you can imagine, is a little bit more challenging, but I think it's pretty rewarding.
Well, we hope that that this interview will inspire some people to buy your book, because it is a very interesting book. Really is.
You know, it's interesting. Our guest last week was a small publisher from North Liberty, Iowa, the Ice Cube Press, a local regional publisher.
Yeah, regional.
And he publishes 4 to 6 books a year. He talked about when he's looking for who he's going to publish, one of the most important things is how many people the author knows, the network. What's the network for selling books? Because in order to publish, you have to make a profit, for a publisher. An author doesn't necessarily, I mean, a lot of people will write whether they make money at it or not, but if you're going to publish, you have to.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, that's been actually, money. I don't want to sound like, greedy or anything, but making money was definitely the major point in publishing. It's important, and trying to make it as an author, I think, there's a lot I can contribute, and people buy books all the time, why not mine?
That's true.
There's a lot of books in the bookstores and a lot of books in the library, and
but finding the niche and finding the way. He also talked about he has to have an author who he can tell will engage with the audience and go do the books readings and so forth.
Yeah.
That there's more to being an author than just the writing process, although that's the most important.
Yeah, it's also the start. It's they said once the book was published, they're like, now your work begins. It's certainly true.
Well, what the title of this book is The Sharp Knife of Forced Simplicity, Volume 1, The Numinous Rebellion, by Ronald S. Kerr. Mm-hmm. It's a book of essays, philosophical essays.
Sure.
Some political-oriented, some humorous, but generally about your take on life.
Right.
What made you decide to write this particular book?
I pretty much had to. I didn't really have much of a choice. And by that I mean I made a commitment to seeing life develop for me in a certain way, that I wanted certain things in my life, and when I realized that I had to make money, I had to get these things out, I had to start acquiring land and things like that. When you look at it and you're like, what's the easiest way to accomplish this? It was writing a book. Writing was the only way to accomplish it easily and without strain. Or you could work some horrible job that pays a lot of money, and then buy things. But writing was the natural expression of that.
For you.
For me, yes. Yes, of course. And so
some people actually like their jobs that pay a lot of money.
Yes, I don't mean to
yeah, they do.
I can't stand jobs personally, but I understand a lot of people enjoy them. So yeah, I pretty much had to write a book. I was surprised really when it turned out to be this book.
And why is that?
When I first started when I made that commitment to write a book, it was about 2.5 years ago. And the first thing I wrote was a novel, which I would say is probably the world's worst novel.
I don't know about that.
It's well, you haven't read it, but it's you know, everyone's their own worst critic. But oh boy, it's awful. And
there's a lot of really bad novels around.
Yeah, this is true.
Can it be fixed? I mean, did you try to fix it?
You know, actually, it's interesting. I learned how to write a book by writing that. I have the full first draft of that novel on it, and I looked at it and I realized that I could definitely salvage it into an interesting story eventually, but it would take two or three full drafts of revision and editing, mm-hmm. things like that. And not only that, but learning how to write the prose. I was about halfway through the book when I realized that I could show the reader something instead of telling them about it. Let's talk
about that, or we'll come back to that. Go ahead and finish, but I want to.
Oh no! Well, I mean, the point was is that eventually I realized that I'd been writing in the style that I wrote The Sharp Knife in for years prior to this, and I was well practiced at it, and I already had developed my voice in that regard, and I realized that it would be significantly easier and probably more lucrative to at least initially publish in that arena first. And then, you know, I can always go back and publish that novel or whatever it turns out to be later. Mm-hmm. But for the immediate, you know, it was important to get this out.
So when you say that you realized that you could show instead of tell, mm-hmm. the reader, but you're saying like in an essay you actually get to do more telling.
Yeah,
it's more appropriate in the essay form.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, in a story you're basically, it's like watching a movie or something like that. There's things going on, and it's the author's job to describe. The story is the storytelling form.
Well, but you can start a new genre, the essay novel.
that's actually good. I'm sure somebody's already done it. That's one thing I noticed. And you know, it's like you said, there are a lot of books out there, and I think everybody's tried everything at this point. But so the trick isn't necessarily to start something new, as it is to give the old thing a new spin,
mm-hmm. right?
Which is what I feel I've somewhat accomplished with this book.
Oh, I think so.
Well, the show don't tell, mm-hmm. Dictum is something that if you've gone to any writing class anywhere, you've heard that.
Right.
But it's not that easy to really understand what that means in practice sometimes.
Yeah, I was shocked that, you know, it was a profound revelation that to me that suddenly it was just, I'm like, well, instead of saying he was angry, I could say, well, he punched the mirror and screamed and blah, 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 and then you infer that he's angry, but it's also a visual event. It's a emotional event. It's not just, you know, he was angry.
Right.
But that does make an interesting contrast to the essay, I think it's not necessarily the same in that my essays aren't necessarily about a person or an event so much as they are an idea. And it's true that I tell people about the ideas, but my goal, I would say, for volume two is to be maybe more of a novel essay in that I don't necessarily want it to be pure conjecture. I want it to be stories about my experiences trying to apply some of the principles that I talk about in volume one to my life, and how they pan out. You know, mm-hmm. It's a much more practical, maybe even like a how-to-do book instead of this is what I think about things. Which is, yeah.
Now you're a fairly young man.
Yeah, he looks young.
Yeah, and did it ever? Did you ever hesitate to like tell the world what you think about life, knowing that your experience is by necessity limited by the number of years you've been here, and that there probably are things that you're going to be learning in the future that may change your ideas somewhat?
I don't think I've ever. Well, how can I say? Well, who was the smartest man in Athens because he realized he didn't know anything? I forget.
One of those
Greeks. Socrates or somebody.
Yeah, yeah. And that was definitely. I mean, writing this book changed my life because, effectively, by saying I'm going to write this book, I sort of declared to life or the universe or God or whoever that I know enough about the subjects that I'm writing about to be egocentric enough to believe that I could be some sort of voice in the world about it. And life responded by basically beating me down. And I mean, the first draft of this book is awful too. I mean, I could barely get 5 pages in, and I'm the author.
Okay.
Yeah. But it was a process of refinement. I didn't know what I wanted to say, and I didn't know how I was going to say it. And that's what makes things difficult to read, is the lack of clarity. And eventually, the thing, when you get sort of beaten down enough, things start, all the things that are being beaten down are the useless things, basically. They start falling away. And then eventually, I got to the point where I knew what I wanted to say, and I knew how I was going to say it. And once I got to that point, that level of clarity, writing the book was a breeze.
It sounds like, in a way, you're describing the title, or how you came to the title of your book.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
The sharp knife of forced simplicity.
Yeah, and forced isn't necessarily like stressing and straining to make something simple. Force is basically the intention of leading a simpler life. And in the process of declaration that I'm going to write a book about simplicity, I mean, the first thing it did was basically showed all my complications to myself and said, you know, you're going to have to let these go. And it eventually
Can you give some examples?
That's an interesting. I'm not sure I can give a specific example. It's much more of a general in life sort of way. One thing was definitely in the prose itself. I didn't have any guidelines or routines or anything when it came to writing this book. I was basically just throwing it together. So, you know, one section would be a paragraph, and the next section would be 12 pages long. But it was a very rambly 12 pages that went all over the place. And
so that had to be refined.
Yeah, it had to be. Basically, it was like I went into my first draft like a person goes into like a gem mine, and basically I just went in and I crossed out most things, and I circled a sentence that I found interesting. And I thought, well, why don't I just talk about that one thing? And when I sat down to talk about that one thing, you'll notice that most articles are only about 2 pages long. That's the amount of time that I got in. Here's the idea. Here's my thoughts about it. The end.
Which I like, because, you know, if you don't have, sit down and read a couple of sections and think about them. And it's an interesting format. I like it.
Thank you. Yeah. I was concerned that it shares too much similarity with blogs and things like that, where, you know.
I wouldn't necessarily. I mean, there is some similarity with the blog. I could see these things having been blogs, except that they are more refined than most bloggers are not doing a lot of editing.
Right.
Well, some do, I'm sure, but a lot of them are not doing a lot of editing in the process, so these are definitely more refined than that. But I wouldn't say that that's something that you should be concerned about, because it's kind of like the whole how we've turned a lot of things in schools to be more like video games and TV, because that's the way kids are used to learning, and their attention spans like that. Well, that's the way a lot of your audience, they have the short attention span, and that's, I mean, and even, you know, I didn't grow up, obviously, in that environment where, you know, we didn't even, I mean, we had computers when I was in high school, but you had to punch the key cards, you know. I mean, it's been a lot of changes. But I have trouble sometimes reading really long, involved essays.
Right.
There's some publications that I get that have very long, involved essays, like Harper's, and they're really intriguing, but sometimes I just get lost. It's just too long, too involved, too complicated.
Yeah.
And I would appreciate a simpler, more focused.
Yeah, I think I'm sort of a product of that video game lifestyle, I guess you could say, because I would say it's not to be self-deprecating, but it's really difficult for me to write a long piece of anything. And have it maintain any sort of internal consistency and be interesting to the reader. I used to write short stories when I was younger, like a lot of short stories, and I'm just used to writing a page or two on any given subject and being done with it. And the few times where I actually did try and write many, many pages, you know, just sort of rambles on and bogs down. And
that's your novel.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I've mentioned this on the show before. You know, Mark Twain's one of my favorite kind of wits of all time. And he once wrote a letter to a friend, and a long letter, and he said, you know, "Dear so-and-so, I would have written you a shorter letter, but I didn't have time." That actually writing a short, concise piece can be more difficult, and take more time than a long, rambling thing.
Yeah, one of my favorite literary techniques or exercises, I guess, is something called 55 fiction, where you write a piece of fiction in 55 words or less.
Wow!
And the people who do it well, it's amazing how evocative it is. That 55 words can just instantly it transports you to another place, and then you're back out again. You know, you just get that little glimpse.
Wow!
But it's definitely a lesson in economy, I guess.
I'll say
55 words. Wow.
Like saying something in 60 seconds or less.
But think of how popular quotes are. Like and Mom ends the show with every week with a quote. A lot of the nonfiction books, and even some of the fiction books that we've interviewed, the authors we've interviewed, use quotes at the beginning of a chapter, end of a chapter. Mm-hmm. People like getting wisdom in short, pithy bursts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do.
Yeah, hopefully that's the strength of my book, that right there.
Well, I would say it is. I mean, so how did you go about publishing this then?
Oh, I have friends in the publishing business.
Uh-huh. That always helps.
It's not what you know, it's who you know. I've established myself as something as a writer, but definitely having friends, you know, in the publishing business, I had sort of a long-standing deal with them that if I wrote a book that they would review it first, obviously, and then publish it. That deal was the basis for writing the book, and that's what started the novel, and then it turned into a whole bunch of other things. So they were waiting for me to bring them a book for about 2 years.
Now, the 2.5 years you spent on this, was that including the novel writing time, or was that
yes? Okay. That's I make that mark about the time I turned 24. I'm 26 now.
Okay.
That was sort of a life changing event, and that's when I realized that I needed to publish the book, and I'd always wanted to write a novel.
Turning 24 was a life-changing event.
Yes.
Why is that?
how to say it? People in my generation talk about the quarter-life crisis.
Right.
That usually starts around 25. I have friends talk about turning 25 was a milestone. For me, it was 24. I guess I identify more with even numbers.
You were just always precocious.
I suppose. And I was living up in Iowa City at the time. I was attending University of Iowa, and the turning 24 was sort of revealed to me my life as a series of concentric circles, and I was at the very center. And then the things that I cared about the most and the people I cared about the most are in that ring with me. And then the next ring was things that I considered less important, but still, you know, and then so far farther out until eventually the things that I just don't care about. And I saw where my attention was, and it was scattered all over the place. It was, you know, half in things that I didn't consider important, half with things, you know, just all over the place. And I realized that, you know, obviously it's my life, and I should be doing what's important to me. So I started to pull out my attention from things that I did not consider important, things that I didn't necessarily even want in my life, that I did because other people thought it was important or because it was assumed that it was important. So I dropped out of the University of Iowa, I moved back to Fairfield, and I wrote a book.
Big changes.
Yeah, I mean, I did it, you know, over time.
Right.
A younger me would have just thrown everything to the wind and, you know, tried to do it like within a month.
Well, as a college student, you're drawn in so many different directions if you take a variety of courses.
Right.
And, you know, it's difficult. It's difficult to zero in on things.
Oh, yeah. This is my big problem with university education. I've actually dropped out of two universities. MUM here in town and University of Iowa. So that makes me something of a professional dropout.
That's good. I dropped out of two also.
Oh.
Yeah, Central and University of Iowa.
Yeah, it's sort of liberating in a way, I think, that when I was working as a bar back in New Mexico in a small town, and I was aimless, and I sat down and I just decided to write out everything that I could possibly want to do in life. It took up like, I don't know, half a notebook. Oh, everything that I wanted to do before I turned 30, actually.
Uh-huh.
And
so you were starting on your bucket list early.
Right. And I decided the best way I could accomplish most of these was to enroll in a university where I would have access to educational resources where I can learn to do the things that I wanted to do. But then when I enrolled in the university, it quickly became clear that the university didn't care about my betterment as a person nor my education. What they cared about was, well, to be honest, they were a degree mill. They wanted my student loan money, and then at the end of a four-year contract, they would give me a slip of paper that said I'm now available for a certain level of job. It had nothing to do with philosophy or education.
Or your development as a person.
Exactly. And so when I realized this, I realized that it would be easier for me to, like, take night classes on a subject or, you know, take one course in something to further my education in that regard. And then over time, I realized that, again, my attention was dispersed over so many different subjects that I really needed to focus in on the one that was really important to me. And that was writing the book, starting to start this career, and then eventually buying land here near town and starting a life there. This was the most important thing. Everything else could drop out, and then that one thread remained. So this is the start of something much bigger.
Well, Ron, why don't you read one of the essays where you talk about your desire for land?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was one of the early ones, I think.
Yeah. Yes. Let me see. The New Wild West, I think. Yes, this is the one where I talk about land and things. The New Wild West. I am ecstatic, literally wild with possibilities. Now, perhaps for the first real time, we exist on the very edge of the cliff. Behind us, the boring dead wastelands of old America, and in front of us, the unknown abyss of a new life. Old America ends in a grand dry sputter as we step forward into the full future of human life on Earth. America today seems rich with science and humanly dead. We have no traditions to speak of, beyond perhaps prom night and turning 18 or 21. If you have culture in your life, it probably came from another country, some rich tradition dating back thousands of years. The rest of us, the average white-bred middle-class Americans, have no culture beyond the hedonism presented in the media, lost children with no one to give us a sense of belonging. Or at least until now. Now we find ourselves in a new light, a reestablishment of important human needs that were dismissed as before as primitive and outdated. These things we see now may not be the most economically efficient or modern, but they are human, structured into our very bones. We look around and see no one has a home, not really. Even if a person owns a house instead of the bank, that person came into entire ownership recently, built by someone else for different people. We move around on the breeze with no roots, from this city to that, for this job or that. Where is the stability in ancestral homelands? Where is the pride of tradition, the secure knowledge that your father's father's father lived here? And as it was, so it will be for your children's children. Where is the pride in craftsmanship? We buy a table mass-produced in another land, thousands exactly like it across the world, cheaply made and designed to break after a set time so you have to buy another. A crafted handmade item of anything is extremely rare and hard to come by, but always solid and longer-lasting, not to mention more beautiful, than anything you could buy in a store. Where is the joy in the local foods and traditions? You buy a food that has traveled thousands of miles to get to the grocery store owned by someone far away. We go to movies made across the nation. We watch television designed to sell you stuff made to break. Where are the local gardens? The farmers' markets that used to be the source of food for a community are now quaint tourist stops. Where are the local events, the town meetings, the summer nights having fun with the entire community? Where are the family traditions and coming-of-age ceremonies? Every ancient civilization had a special rite of passage for children to become adults, a welcoming into the adult community with all the rights and responsibilities included. Without this, children get older without ever becoming adults, without ever understanding what it entails and what it means. Where are the strong family ties, the special and unique family traits and traditions, the clans of families banding together in communities and relationships? Where are the family crests and flags, the land and the houses, the history and the future? What makes me jump is not the lack of these things in our modern American life. It is the possibility for them now. We exist right here on that edge, and we can literally make up anything, anything we like. Our play becomes the games and holidays of our progeny. Perhaps it changes over time to something we don't recognize, or perhaps it has been done away with altogether. It's not our place to guess what the future looks like, but we can choose a direction to take. For myself, I see the land I wish to become my family's ancestral homeland, so I will obtain the money and purchase it. I see in my mind the house I wish to give those who come after me, so I will build it. I see the fun and the history I wish to give my great-grandkids, and so I make it. I look around at the world today and pick the best it has to offer, the highest of science and religion and spirituality and sustainable living and arts and literature and all the rest of it. I take these things and put them inside me, deep inside my home, on and all over my land. I breathe, sleep, and eat it. I see through it and over it and beyond it. And I bring to me like-minded people. Together we establish the ground for the rest of history. People always say things like, well, what if your kids decide they don't want to live here? I don't care. The point is that it is there for them and for their kids, or for their kids on down the line. The knowledge that they will always have a place to be, a place where they belong, and this place will grow the food and have the shelter they need to live comfortably. And if, after I'm dead, my family-to-be shakes their heads at my ridiculous vision and sells a lot off, well, I'll have moved on to some equally improbable vision.
Yeah.
So that sort of, in a nutshell, describes, rather large nutshell, describes my long-term plans, I guess you could say.
Does that sound at all familiar, Mom?
Yeah, sure did. I like her father.
Yeah. We came to Iowa so that he could buy that land, because where we lived in Pennsylvania, it was too expensive.
Yeah, land was
very expensive
to buy
that land, and he bought 200 acres down in Davis County and built a pond and planted trees.
He didn't have to plant a lot of trees. There was 100 acres of trees already.
Yeah. Wow. But then he planted walnut trees, and he didn't he?
Fruit trees.
Fruit trees, but also walnut trees, I think, for harvest. And grapes and various berries.
Raspberries. Right. Well, he had gold raspberries. You ever tasted a gold raspberry?
Oh. No.
Boy, is that good.
Yeah. Asparagus
that's
patches.
Primo.
And
yeah.
He didn't get around to building the house.
The house was falling down that was on the property. So.
Mm.
I'm
going to build a house out of stone.
Oh, good choice.
Yeah, that's not common here. That's very common where I grew up in Pennsylvania.
Right.
Everything's brick there.
Stone. A lot of stone houses.
Too. Yeah.
My grandparents' house was stone.
I imagine it's going to take a lot of money. That's why I'm sort of banking on becoming a bestseller.
Well, out there, the reason the houses are built of stone is because when the farmers cleared the fields,
right.
They had all the stone left
right,
over.
Right.
Or if you go to Ireland, not only are the houses all built of stone, all the fences are built of stone because they had all the stone,
right.
And that's what they did with it. And I guess we were, Iowa was fortunate we didn't have to dig all these stones out of the fields in order to farm it.
It's true, but we were less fortunate in the fact that we lost most of our farmland over the past 100 years or so.
Yeah.
But
now, do you have any experience with gardening, farming, growing your own food?
At this point, not much. My family's had a garden on and off for forever, I guess. I took a workshop down at MUM on sustainable agriculture,
mm-hmm.
Which I found very illuminating. And I'm going to be farming all of my family's property this coming spring once the ground thaws. I make the assertion several times in the book that
that you want to grow your own food.
Yes, and I probably should have some experience in that before I start really hammering that as
yeah, that's right.
The second book, then my next book that I'm going to write is going to be hammering this point also, that you can grow your own food for significantly less time and effort than it would take to have a full-time job to get money to buy your food.
Of course, you're going to have to preserve a lot of food because the growing season is very short here.
Right, it's true. And actually, greenhouses are fairly productive. Mm-hmm. I was talking to a friend of mine who said that in the coldest day in July, the greenhouse was 90 degrees with 100%
coldest
humidity.
Coldest day in January.
Yeah. Yeah. So the... Sorry, did I say July?
Yes, you did.
winter.
Okay.
So this is the important part. That we have this return to the land and this return to sustainable agriculture and things like that is not necessarily a step backwards in terms of farming methods and things like this. This is, we have the full extent of science, we have the full extent of knowledge, technology, every little bit of it right now we can use to make that return to the land as healthy and as economically viable and as fruitful. I mean, this is not a return to the Stone Age. This is a step forward for human civilization. This is not a step back.
You plan on having livestock too?
Not necessarily. But the thing is, I mean, no man is an island. So the land that I want to buy is this entire valley. It's just south of town, and I plan on having a lot of people live in this valley with me. And so I don't necessarily have to grow all my own food for me and my family. I just have to grow enough that I can, you know, easily exchange it with other people for the things that I don't necessarily have the time, like chickens or, you know, things like that.
Most interesting.
Well, Ron, let's talk a little bit about your development as a writer. You said that you wrote short stories for years and years.
Yeah.
Did you ever try and publish any of them?
Yeah. For a while back in high school, I was submitting short stories to science fiction magazines.
So they were mostly science fiction stories?
They were, for the most part, science fiction or just all sorts of speculative fiction, fantasy, just regular fiction sometimes. When I was younger, I attended the Young Writers Workshop.
Mm-hmm.
You're only supposed to do it once, but I managed to go about 3 or 4 times.
That's because he looks young.
So. Is that sponsored by the Southeast Iowa?
Yeah, I'm not
Prairie
sure.
Education.
That sounds familiar. And that definitely was a big help because I went probably my freshman year of high school, and then pretty much every year after that, and I could definitely see a change in the strength of my writing from having done all those things. Basically, I just snuck in because nobody else wanted to go. So, short stories. I have a lot of short stories that I wrote when I was younger. And
when you submitted them, did you get any response at all?
No. It turns out they weren't very good.
Oh.
Now for my age level, they're probably pretty good.
Right.
But you know, as I got older, I looked back at the things that I'd written earlier, and I'm like, well, this is awful. You know, how come everyone told me it was so good when quite clearly it's not very good, and I can write so much better now?
It's because you were 14, and for a 14-year-old, it was good.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And but this became such a problem for me that I eventually just gave up on writing for a while, and I went several years without writing any short stories or anything like that. But
now, did you keep a journal?
I did keep a journal for a while. It wasn't necessarily Dear Diary, Here Are My Thoughts. It was more of a recording of events, I guess you could say. But I did keep writing, was the thing. I just didn't realize that I was writing at the time. I was writing emails. I was involved heavily on online debate, which I think is... you can sort of tell that for a while, that especially for debating online. Like I just did a ton of religious debate online.
So what's online debate? I'm not.
Just basically, like you would go to people will have groups, online groups, where they will have forum discussions and billboard posts. Like here is something that I think about religion or philosophy or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And people respond to it, and it's just this huge mess, basically, where everyone's...
So it isn't a structured thing.
Not necessarily. Not in any sort of formal sense. And when you're in that arena, you have to get in and say what you want to say, And then, you know, and then by the time you get her bound back to it, five other people weighed in on your opinion.
And some of them meanly.
Oh, almost all of them.
Viciously.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And I was, it might be hard to believe, but I was something of a radical in my youth.
No, I'm shocked.
So I was posting the most radical things that I could think of. I was very into, I guess you could say, the philosophy of religion. What it means for a person and the role it plays in their life and things like that. But eventually I gave that up too. But, you know, throughout the whole thing, I mean, I've been online pretty much my whole life. It's ruined my sleeping habits, and I have glasses that I wear because staring at the screen for too long and things like that. But what it did was is that it basically trained me to think and write in a manner similar to the way it is in the book, perhaps less refined, but still that. So I guess you could say that's more of my training as an author than actually like writing or belonging to writers' groups or things like that.
Now, have you ever belonged to a writers' group?
I don't think so.
Did you get, like, as you were writing this, did you get any feedback as you went?
No. None at all. To be fair, I think my mom read my first draft.
Okay.
And she said it was good.
That's it.
So, well, I mean, this is it was so involved that, I mean, I don't think anybody, you know, I've had people that I occasionally, like, I gave my novel to a couple people, and they all said it was pretty awful. So that was a good sign.
agreed with you then.
Yeah, it wasn't just me.
Now, when you gave it to them, did you preface it by saying, you know, I think this is pretty awful. What do you think? Or did they come up with that on their own?
I mean, you could tell they came up with it on their own because they'd finish it and they'd be like, so, your novel's interesting.
I was going to say, these are good friends.
Yeah, these are good friends whose opinions I trust quite a bit.
So they didn't want to be mean. They didn't want to tell you what they really thought, but they needed to tell you what they thought.
No, but, I mean, at some point when they're going over the list of things that could be improved, you know, you realize the list is longer than the novel. It's like, okay, I get it.
Okay. I'm going to be interested to see in this novel when it comes out.
Yeah. I think I've built it up a little too much. Now I have to write one. Well, that's fine. I don't mind. I should do that. I mean, it's a list of things to conquer, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are some of the qualities that you have that make you successful as a writer?
Well, my success is debatable at this point.
Well, you've written and
this
you've
is true.
Published, so that's
okay. Well, in that term of success, I guess you could say it wasn't for its own sake. I've talked to some authors and some people who would be authors, and the problem that I've seen almost universally is that they get so involved with the book that it's hard for them to finish it and publish it because it's an integral part of who they are.
And it's never done.
Right.
Because you're never done.
Right, exactly. And yeah. And a book like this, I could continue to write forever because, as you said, you know, as you get older, I mean, there are some things in the book that I don't necessarily agree with now, and I just published this book a couple months ago. I understand this process.
Yeah.
And I think that understanding that process was the biggest help for me because it wasn't a question of getting the book. It was obviously a question of getting the book as good as I could get it to be published so I can put my name on it and feel proud of it. That was important. But it wasn't about writing the perfect book. It wasn't even necessarily about perfecting the book. It's volume one of a series of books that will take me the rest of my life to write. The important thing was to write it, to put it in a book, and then when it's published, it's done. It's not a part of me anymore. And this is why I'm looking forward to getting feedback from people I don't know, because it just doesn't affect me anymore. I'm interested to hear what people have to say about it, because it's like it's something outside of myself. It's like, what do you think of that circus over there? You know, I'm not part of the circus. I just went there once. And
you're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and I can't believe how tardy I've been about saying that.
No. Yeah.
And we're speaking today with Ron Kerr, author of The Sharp Knife of Forced Simplicity, Volume 1, The Numinous Rebellion.
The reason you were tardy in doing that is because our person we're interviewing is so interesting.
Oh, thank you.
We've gotten quite engaged in this conversation, mm-hmm. to where I neglected my hosting duties. So now I lost my train of thought because I had to interrupt by saying once again that this is Writer's Voices. Yes.
this book is I won't say it's easy to read because there are some parts of it that take a lot of thought, which is not a bad thing.
Right. Yeah, that's good.
Trying to see what you're trying to say, but in the end, you're always able to glean what you're trying to say, and that's important.
Oh, good. I'm glad that happened. I have a tendency to be somewhat convoluted in my thinking, I think, which is definitely something I'm trying to apply the sharp knife forced simplicity to.
Yeah. Good thinking.
But I'm glad that you could. I mean, at least figure out what the point I was trying to make, I guess.
Well, the blurb on the back of the book is from Angela Mylander, PhD, and she was a teacher of
right,
yours.
Right, yes.
She writes, "The writing is clean and clear, and the insights are informed with the passion and excitement of original discovery." That's high praise.
Yeah.
Now, the rest of the blurbs on the back are rather interesting. Why'd you decide to write blah, 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 blah?
Well, I actually designed the cover, more or less.
Okay.
And when I was designing the back, I needed a placeholder for where the book annotation would go. So I just wrote this book, blah, 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 and I just cut and pasted to take up the amount of space that I wanted to take up in the back.
Mm-hmm.
And when I submitted it to the publisher, they thought it was hilarious. And then they said, "You should have this as the back of your book." And I'm like, well, okay, you know, I'll go along with what the publisher says. So it's been a pretty big hit so far. The big complaint I've had from people is they don't really know what the book is about until they actually read it.
Well, that's true.
That's okay. That's why you read a book, is to find out what it's about.
It's true. It might be hurting online sales a little bit because the only description on the internet is the little blurb about me, which isn't necessarily descriptive of anything either.
Mm.
It was kind of just sort of some nonsense I wrote down.
Okay, let me see a minute.
So, tell us a little bit about your publisher.
First World Publishing?
Mm-hmm.
They're good people.
They've been...
First World Publishing.
Yeah, we had the owner on our show a year or so ago. It's been quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about how they work, what type of publishing...
Well, they're print-on-demand, which I guess the way it was sort of described to me was they split the difference between regular traditional publisher and a vanity press. They have review guidelines. You know, they won't publish anything. You have to meet their standards, I guess you could say. But what they do is they don't. My understanding of a traditional publisher is there's something like a record industry in that they'll find your book and they'll say, okay, we're going to publish your book, and then they'll do some deal like they'll loan you the money, and then they'll print all these copies out, but you'll owe them, and then you have to pay for the storage, and then you're going on these book tours that they promote to basically pay back the publisher for the cost of printing, and in the meantime you might be able to squeak by in terms of making a living. Vanity press, on the other hand, you print whatever you want, it's up to you to sell it, there's no help. But First World kind of splits the difference. They will help you promote your book once it's published, and it's print on demand, which means there's no warehousing costs or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Basically, you go online and you order my book, it gets sent over to, I don't know, wherever, and they print out a copy, just one copy, and then they ship it to you, which is, I mean, it's brilliant. I mean, it's going to change the face of publishing if it hasn't
Indeed.
Started already.
Yeah,
right.
Just not having warehouses full of books that you have to sell alone is a huge plus.
Oh, yeah.
And then that also allows for a much higher return for the author. You get
a higher percentage of the cover price than you would under traditional publishing.
Yeah, they actually split it about 50-50, so, which is pretty nice. But on the other hand, they don't have the marketing resources or even investment necessarily that a large publisher has. So it's up to me.
And they don't give you an advance.
Right. And so it's up to me to basically promote the book. You know, I can't have the publisher like setting up a book signing road trip tour, you know, or anything like that. I have to take the time to do that, to try and get on the radio and things like that.
You know, in some magazines there'd be like a couple pages where they have short reviews of books. I wonder how you get into that. I don't know.
If you're publishing with a major publisher, they have the connection. It's much tougher if you're doing it more independently.
It's actually there's some disadvantages for being local. Like even they were saying Prairie Lights up in Iowa City is, you know, big. They have big name people going through there all the time, but they actually dislike people from Fairfield. Because of a couple book things that went through back in the 90s or something like that. So I'm already associated with a group of people that may not be like the biggest benefit, at least locally. But these are all small matters that will be overcome. And even this book, I mean, I'm not necessarily too involved in promoting this book. I'm obviously promoting it, but my second book will be something that I'm really going to throw my whole weight behind.
And why is that?
My second book is not going to be volume 2, actually. It's going to be...
Volume 3?
Just to throw you off. The tentative title right now is The Numinous Rebellion, or The Elimination of Scarcity Using Sustainable Methods as the Only Means of Effective Social Change. And I cover this topic in the book.
Yeah,
but very briefly. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the Numinous Rebellion, the article called The Numinous Rebellion, is the one article in the book that I dislike the most like the least. because it's such a huge topic for me, and I barely scratched the surface of it.
Okay, what is the Numinous Rebellion?
Well, numinous means... because people think it's numbers or things like that. Numinous, if you think of a light bulb as luminous, mm-hmm. Numinous, you could say, is spirit or holiness or consciousness or, you know, that sense of awe and divine presence, that sort of thing. So a numinous rebellion is a revolution that has holiness or sacredness at its core. It's something that basically has love at its center. So that's a term I use. That's a shorthand term for the practical application, which is.
Did you originate that term?
Yeah, I think so. I opened the dictionary one day and saw numinous, and I'm like, rebellion. I just put them together. That just clicked. The big thing that I've really been noticing is that all of human society, all of our history up until now, has been based on the idea of scarcity, or at least the threat of scarcity, that there might not be enough to go around, so we have to band together in these nations and cities, and, you know, this whole thing that it's us versus them because they might take our resources and things like that. And even though we have enough to eat now, we're fighting for imaginary resources like freedom, as if there's not enough freedom to go around. The government's the only supply of this precious resource from freedom, and we have to defend our freedom. These things are ridiculous, and they're outdated, and that's the important part. We know enough now, using sustainable, grow biointensive agricultural methods, that science and technology, where we can eliminate scarcity from the face of the planet.
Now, how would you answer the scientists who say that the reason that we can grow enough now is because we're using chemical fertilizers and so forth, and that if we returned to organic, we would not be able to feed the masses?
Well, see, here's the thing. It's not organic. It's specifically the grow biointensive movement. I wish I had. The problem is I'm not very good at research, but effectively, what grow biointensive does is you can take 300 million people, this is the population of the United States, and you can have one effectively sustainable agriculture, which means, and it's local and it's organic, and you can do it. You can have all 300 million people in Iowa, Illinois, and Nebraska, and half of that land is converted into wilderness. That's effective distribution of resource. That's sustainability. So 6 billion people on the planet's not a big deal. It's really not. If everyone's growing their own food and they have the thing, if it's sustainable. And right now it's a question of education and it's a question of management resources.
So this book that you're working on now, is it kind of a how-to?
Yeah. It basically, I need a research assistant because I'm not very good at research. But the point of the book, I guess you could, the book is a how-to manual. It goes point by point in terms of the individual's life and then on a community level on how to eliminate every area of scarcity from life. So it's a how-to manual, but the focus, or I guess the viewpoint, and this is where I think I can really create a niche market, is not sustainability for its own sake. There's a lot of people out there who are very into the sustainability movement because they want to farm, they want to feed their families, and they want to do these things. But there's a lot of other people out there who are into social change, revolutionary people, you know, the problems that they have with government, but they can't fully win. They can never win, I guess you could say, because government it's imaginary. You can't kill it. It exists only in the minds of the people. And the reason it exists is because the people are afraid of scarcity. So if you can teach the people, if you can create sustainability, self-sufficiency with the people and every community being fully self-sufficient, what you do is you eliminate the need, the dependence on government. And when the people don't need the government anymore, then the government is forced to change itself to provide only benefits for those people who want to be a part of it. And that's the thing. Right now, we are dependent upon government and society and gasoline, electricity, and it's this huge
infrastructure.
You know, food travels over 1,000 miles to reach your dinner plate. We're dependent on it. We're effectively slaves of it. But if you can create enough self-sufficiency and sustainable self-sufficiency in your own life and in your community, then your dependency on these mechanisms lessen until eventually people just opt out. They say, well, the detriments of belonging to this organization are no longer worth my time. And when that happens, then you have effective revolution. Then you have a change on the social and governmental level that actually matters. Until then, you're just basically, you have a truck, and then someone's driving the truck, and someone's like, I don't like the way this person's driving the truck. You can't get them out, and someone else drives the truck. It doesn't change the structure of the mechanics of society.
Still got the truck.
Right, exactly. So
and we're all in the truck together.
Exactly. The numinous rebellion, so that's what the rebellion is.
Okay.
It's a rebellion of self-sufficiency, of sustainability. It's a liberation from the bondage that we find ourselves basically ensnared in by virtue of belonging to this society.
Well, Ron, we have only about 5 minutes left. You want to read another short piece?
Sure. I'm afraid I'm rambling on there for a while.
From The Sharp Knife of Forced Simplicity by Ronald Kerr.
Any requests?
Do the fingernail one.
I can do that.
This is more on the humorous side.
Yeah, this is humorous.
Yeah. I don't suppose you
remember.
It's
a laugh out loud
55.
One.
55. 55. Right.
Okay. Long fingernails. Long fingernails freak me out. I don't mean in any sort of alarmist way, rather just sort of hesitancy. I'm afraid I'm going to get scratched. I mean, look at those things. They're not nails, they're talons. Sharp-edged weapons at the end of every finger. And I'm supposed to let those claws near my soft bits? I don't think so, lady. Painting them doesn't help. It just draws attention to the tiny biological sorms aimed at my vitals. A big old neon warning sign. I understand that long fingernails are considered pretty by their owners and perhaps other people with long fingernails so that they can all gather around in mutual appreciation and back scratches. The rest of us live under a thin, glossy sheen of finger-related violence. I don't really get the purpose of them beyond having something pretty to look at. They break seemingly all the time, from the perspective of one who's never had them. They get in the way, effectively preventing you from typing, punching, and playing the guitar, or at least on one hand. And when you do cover them with paint, it just chips off soon thereafter, leaving a strange blotch of color on each one. In conclusion, long fingernails are the source of misery, pain, and suffering, not just for the owner, but all those flayed in the process of interaction.
Now, I'm just curious as to, you know, why, how you chose what topics you were going to include in this, because you do range over...
cover quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much whatever caught my fancy. It wasn't necessarily about the subject as it was the, I guess you could say, the importance of the subject at the time.
I mean, the fingernail one kind of caught me by surprise. Because there was some, you know, the deeper philosophical things, and then all of a sudden, this one about fingernails.
Right. I guess you could say I'm concerned with practicality. Mm. I guess that's sort of the common theme of the book, is this sort of convoluted sense of practicality that I have. So when things strike me as very impractical, then I feel the need to comment upon
them. Call attention to that.
So obviously society and government and all these things are very impractical. But also long fingernails seem to be very impractical and also potentially harmful.
Yeah.
Well, I guarantee that you can't play the guitar with long fingernails. I mean, you see somebody that's doing it, they've open corded the thing and they're just moving their hand up. They're not.
Right.
Because I tried to play the other day and I couldn't do it.
Your fingernails were too long. Mm.
Fingernails too long. So I cut them.
Now, Ron, are there any like essayists or nonfiction writers that you particularly admire?
Henry Miller specifically. Mm. Henry Miller was, actually haven't really read most of his
novels.
Most of his like well known works. I actually discovered The Wisdom of the Heart and Stand Still Like the Hummingbird and things of that. I have read three or four of those books. It's basically his shorter essays. And it opened up the door for me that someone could talk about themselves so honestly. And also everything that he chose to comment on seems it had such honesty to it. I mean, he would swear, he'd use a swear word, and it wasn't obscene or anything like that, at least not in my view. It was justified and necessary, and that was the word to use. Mm-hmm. And it was profound, because, I mean, I was used to swear words as just being vulgar, and you could always find a way around it, but that was the word that he had to use at that time. And his voice and his writing style was so similar to what I wanted to be. It was like saying, I'm going to go build a house or a mansion on that hill. And you get to that hill, and someone's built a much nicer mansion than you were planning. And it's just sort of frustrating. And eventually I realized, you know, that he had his own writing style and his life and that sort of thing that I was separate from. But it was still something that was,
Well, we are out of time.
And went fast,
it went
didn't
fast.
It?
So we've been speaking with Ron Kerr. This has been Writer's Voices. Stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore. If you're listening on Friday, if you're listening to our rebroadcast Monday morning, stay tuned for The Cult Show. And we'll close with a quote from Mom.
You know, sometimes advice would be more comfortable if it didn't conflict with our plans.
See you next week on Writer's Voices. And thanks for being with us, Ron.
Thank you.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.